Welcome to this week's Boat Briefing podcast. Now, we're in the midst of a busy boat show season, so this week we've decided to do a special episode coming to you from the Monaco and London offices of law firm HFW. Perfect listening for anyone who's shopping for a yacht right now. Now, owning a superyacht is a complex, high-stakes business. Buying, selling, building or chartering, every stage involves varying layers of contracts, regulations, taxes, inspections, and of course some serious financial commitments. And even the smallest misstep can lead to costly delays, disputes or unexpected liabilities. That's why every decision demands careful planning and trusted expert advice. So in this episode, we get to the heart of yacht buying, building and chartering, crunching it down to the essentials that give prospective owners a clearer picture of what lies ahead. To guide us, three HFW specialists tackle the key questions owners are most likely to ask. So whether it's your first yacht or your fifth, their insights will help you safeguard your investment and approach each stage of the process with greater confidence in this intricate, high-value market. We really hope you find it useful. So our first expert is Andrew Charlier, Head of Yachts and Partner at HFW's Monaco office. With extensive experience advising leading shipyards and high-profile yacht owners, Andrew is going to answer some of the key questions yacht owners often have when buying or selling a superyacht. He'll guide listeners through essential topics such as due diligence, title verification, contract structures, post-sale liability, mortgages and liens, and VAT. Whether it's your first yacht or a high-value sale, Andrew's insights will help you recognise complex transactions and understand common pitfalls. Okay, Andrew, so what are the common legal red flags in secondhand superyacht transactions for buyers and sellers?
Each transaction has its own specificities, so there's no one size fits all answer. And of course, if we start from the assumption that the key commercial terms have already been agreed, then I think there is a couple of aspects that we would want to highlight as potential red flags that you need to be thinking about at an early stage. And the first of those is ensuring that the seller and buyer know who they're dealing with, and they're comfortable with that. We've become familiar with the phrase know your customer or KYC. So sellers and buyers at an early stage have carried out some basic KYC and due diligence on the counterparty to make sure that the transaction can go ahead. So you really do want to be dealing with that at the outset. Otherwise, you can find yourself with problems down the line when it comes to payment or when it comes to transfer of title. So what does that mean? I guess it means that you're wanting to ensure that you know the identity, source of wealth, source of funds for the seller and the buyer parties and their ultimate beneficial owners. And also you want to make sure that any compliance requirements that the banks might have are also satisfied, because after all, they're going to be involved in transmitting or receiving the transaction funds. So you've got those KYC and due diligence requirements as a really important first step in any successful transaction. And I guess I would mention as well, a link to that, we have to make sure that we've run our sanctions checks, that we know that we can deal with the counterparties in the transaction, and that we're not faced with anything that might impact transfer of funds later. So I guess that's something that I would mention as a common legal red flag at the outset of a superyacht transaction. And I suppose as a secondary point, we talk about confidentiality in the industry quite a lot. And you sometimes find a seller, for example, is receiving offers from multiple buyers through brokers. Obviously, you're expecting that the broker will have pre-cleared the credentials of the buyer that is being put to you. But maybe you're taking the view that you don't particularly want to disclose too much about your structure and other seller issues, sell side issues until you at least have got a signed letter of intent. You've got perhaps a signed MOA in place so that you know that the buyer is serious, there's a reasonable chance of the transaction proceeding. And only at that point, probably, are you going to be accepting to provide evidence of title and ownership to a buyer. So we can often find there will be perhaps approaches made, efforts made, contacts made to sellers from buyers, but there may be some reluctance to go too far down with that, engaging in that process until you've established the credibility of the buyer.
Right. Okay, thank you. Interesting. Okay, so tell me the key differences between a MOA and a PSA, a purchase and sale agreement. What are they used for?
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about two standard form agreements that have been put in place by sales brokers organizations respectively in Europe and in the US. The MEBA MOA is the standard contract which is used for most European-based transactions. And we have, we're doing deals on the 2005 version of the MEBA MOA. It was updated in 2021, so sometimes we use that one as well. In the US, on the other hand, the brokers over there have put in place a purchase and sale agreement, or PSA, which is their standard form. So we sometimes have a battle of the forms between which document we're going to use. And it's interesting to see that many of the yacht purchases are for US-based buyers. So perhaps they have a natural preference for the PSA as being their home document as opposed to the European MEBA MOA. But I do think that increasingly now the yacht lawyers that are very active in the industry on both sides of the pond are quite comfortable with both documents. So you'll very often see the Florida lawyers quite happy to use a MEBA MOA and vice versa. So it's less of an issue than it was. But it does matter which one you choose, because there's certainly one very key difference between the two, which, what exactly have you contracted? What exactly have you done when you signed the contract? Mm-hmm. And the difference is in relation to the ability of the buyer to disengage from the transaction after signature. So in the case of the MOA, the philosophy is that if I'm selling my yacht, then the buyer has to sign an MOA, put in place a 10% deposit, and that gives the buyer then the right to have a sea trial and carry out a condition survey with a full right of rejection after sea trial within 24 hours usually, but only a limited right of rejection after survey. So whilst the seller is locked in to the MEBA MOA at signature, the buyer is not. It is subject to sea trial and survey, but with a limited right of rejection on the buyer's side. So from the point of view of the seller, it's more advantageous, I would say, to sign a MEBA MOA, because you've got a buyer that's a little bit more on the hook. On the other hand, with the PSA, the PSA is structured differently, so that it's in effect, it's only creating an option in favor of the buyer. So the buyer can reject the yacht for any reason, provided it does so by the relevant deadline in the contract. So it's from the US perspective, that's how they've put their contracts in place, and they believe that that's the right approach to take for buyers. The buyer should be protected in that way. In Europe, we've tended to operate on the basis that we like to have a little bit more commitment from the buyer before we'll tie ourselves up into a purchase process, and therefore we prefer to have a signed MEBA MOA a limited right of rejection for the buyer.
So MOA is more seller friendly and PSA more buyer friendly, would you say?
In relation to this aspect, certainly, yes. And I think the key difference can come down to the fact that if you've signed a MEBA MOA as a buyer, you've accepted the yacht after sea trial, your surveyor has found some defects. Then it depends on how serious those defects are. If the defects are fairly minor, you have to proceed with the purchase at the agreed price. Mm. If, on the other hand, these are actionable defects as defined in the contract, i.e. serious enough that you have an option, you have a right to withdraw, then you can. But it means that you are, particularly after you've carried out your sea trial and you've had your 24 hours to accept or reject, after that, you have limited rights of rejection. And what's important in both contracts is to make sure that you pay attention to the deadlines that are set out in the contract and make sure that if you want to do something, you have to do it before the deadline, because otherwise you'll find yourself having deemed to accept something or have potentially lost a right of rejection that you've been granted under the contract. So you know, it's always sensible to make sure that you're represented by an experienced yacht lawyer that can guide you through the process.
Interesting, yes. And the difference between sale and purchase of the yacht as an asset and the sale and purchase of an owning structure of the yacht. Do you want to talk us through that?
The MOA and the PSA are doing the same thing. They're providing for the asset sale and purchase. So the seller company is selling the yacht to usually a buyer company. It's not a sale of the owning company or the owning structure. On the other hand, a share sale and purchase is a sale of the owning structure from the shareholders of the owning company to the buyer. So it's a very different thing. And we do periodically get an inquiry from buyers that have selected a yacht and agreed terms. And then they'll say, well, okay, well, I see I've got to set up an owning company. I've got to choose my flag. I've got to work out the best structure for me. But actually, you know, when I look at what the seller has set up, it works pretty well. And I think it would work for me. So why don't we just save a step and have me acquire the seller company rather than acquiring the yacht? So there is a superficial attraction to that. The difficulty, the devil is always in the detail. And the detail here is that if you're acquiring not just the asset, but also the shares in the company, that comes with a different set of risks for the buyer, because the buyer is taking on potentially all the existing historic liabilities of the yacht owning company, which is being purchased. So it's the same as an M&A deal in the corporate world, where when a business is bought and sold, you'd expect to see quite extensive warranties that a buyer will require from the seller in relation to those liabilities. And of course, it's a different document entirely that is required if you're buying the owning company. So as I say, it's superficially attractive. We do it sometimes, and there can be overriding reasons why the parties want to do it that way. But generally speaking, what we find is that once we explain to the buyer in particular what's required, then you realize that it's not actually going to be saving any time or less complex, but the reverse.
Probably, yeah, even more complex than it is. Okay, great. Talk to us about VAT, because that's an interesting area.
Yeah, I think going back to the whole idea of what are we doing when we're buying and selling a second-hand yacht, and a lot of this is down to just the law of the contract, whether it's a US law PSA or an English law MOA. So your US law or English law qualified advisors will be able to advise you on the terms of the contract. But in addition to dealing with the law of the contract, you also have to bear in mind that we're dealing with maritime regulations and laws, conventions in relation to the flag, in relation to the vessel. And you're also having to deal with taxation and customs aspects. So the European Union is a customs territory. There are rules which operate in relation to goods circulating in the EU. And there are also provisions which allow foreign flagged yachts to come into the EU and operate, be in free circulation under an exemption. But in terms of a sale, you have to consider what the status of the yacht is from a VAT perspective of the yacht that you're selling or buying. And then we also have to check whether or not some VAT might become due on the sale of the asset itself. And if you look at the broker listings for yachts, very often they'll talk about a yacht being VAT paid or not VAT paid. And if a yacht is being sold as VAT paid, then that's a status that has to be investigated by the buyer. And it can be an important status for certain buyers. And if you haven't investigated, and if it turns out that it isn't actually VAT paid, even though everybody thinks it is, that can have some serious consequence later on, potentially for the buyer who is cruising in EU waters, assuming that they're doing so with a VAT-paid boat, find that they're not. So it's an important aspect of a yacht sale that has to be checked where the yacht's been sold as VAT-paid. And importantly, it also it's crucial to ensure that you've checked, considered carefully where the place of delivery of the yacht is going to be when the yacht's handed over to from seller to buyer in the context of this VAT paid status, if we're dealing with a VAT paid boat. And yeah, obviously there are, the devil is in the detail again in terms of what we're dealing with, but generally speaking, if it's a VAT paid yacht, then you probably would expect that delivery is going to take place in EU waters. Whereas if it's not VAT paid, then generally you'd expect the yacht delivery to take place in international waters outside the scope of EU VAT. So that's the sort of VAT paid side of things. But then we also have to consider, like any asset that's sold between one company to another company, is there VAT due on, is a transaction taxable from a VAT point of view? And that is generally a question of the place of delivery as well. So it's something that we deal with in the MOA as the standard position being that the risk of the VAT on the delivery and transfer of ownership from seller to buyer is with the buyer. So you know, a buyer needs to be sure that it has considered that the delivery location is properly advised and this aspect is adequately addressed.
And from a seller's point of view, it can affect the value of the yacht, is that correct?
That's going back to the VAT paid status point. Okay. So, if I'm an EU resident buyer and I'm buying a yacht and I'm intending to keep the yacht in the Med, then I need to make sure that the yacht's either VAT paid or I've got a solution in place to deal with the VAT paid status after the purchase. And that's why you see these yachts being advertised as VAT paid, because it means that from a buyer's point of view, provided that VAT paid status is valid, you've dealt with solution. You've got a solution in place for the issue. If you don't have a solution and you need a solution, then buyers are either having to import and pay the VAT or they're having to put in place some sort of leasing arrangement, either an operating lease or some sort of finance lease in order to ensure that the yacht is able to be in free circulation in the EU, given that you are an EU resident owner. It's a complex subject and appropriate professional advice needs to be taken.
And the last question, Andrew, so beyond a physical survey, what due diligence should a buyer insist on to ensure the yacht is legally secure?
Yeah, and the physical survey is really important, isn't it? We touched on earlier on the idea with whether it be the MOA or the PSA, that you have this subject to survey type of approach. And the reason for that being that the condition of the yacht isn't warranted by the seller. So it's a caveat emptor situation. If you're a buyer, you will receive a warranty as to title, you will receive a warranty as to liens, but you won't receive one as to condition. So that's why you need to have used a professional surveyor to inspect, check the condition of the yacht, report to you on that condition, and ensure that the vessel condition is as you think it should be. And you can't then go back to the seller and complain if something crops up later. As to other due diligence, then we really are talking about the other two things which are warranted in the MOA. So those are covered in the MOA, one of which is legal title and one of which is ownership. So from the point of view of legal title, it's going to be a case of the buyer making sure that it's carried out proper investigation as to the chain of title, not just at the point of sale, but in terms of the history of the yacht, perhaps going back to the original construction, but certainly going back at least 5 years, looking at any intervening changes in ownership, checking the situation, checking that there's a good chain and that there are no red flags or question marks in relation to legal title. And then the other point is liens. And we have this concept in maritime law of maritime liens, a good example being crew wages. So if the seller forgets to pay its crew, hands over the yacht to the unsuspecting buyer, and then a couple of months down the road, the buyer arrives at a port and then finds to be greeted by an arrest order from somebody representing the crew member that hasn't been paid. That's an example of a lien that has arisen, which survived the change of ownership and can bite on the yacht, and therefore it becomes a problem for the buyer. So clearly, from a due diligence point of view, you do need to make sure that A, you've done as much as you can in terms of investigating the situation, getting all the necessary checks and balances in place with the delivery documents to cover all the usual lien risks. So that's partly going to be checking that there are no mortgages. There's going to be checking the situation with crew and no unpaid harbour dues, etc. So you've got all of those usual points that get checked. But in addition to that, you're going to want probably to consider whether you're sufficiently protected by the seller's warranty in the MOA, because your seller's a company set up perhaps in an offshore jurisdiction that only owns the yacht, and once the yacht has been sold, the sales proceeds will find their way back up to the shareholder, and that company will be dissolved. So if your maritime lien occurs a few months down the line and you're left with a shell company as a buyer, you've got nobody to turn to. So the way that that's generally dealt with, and MIBA have thought about this and put in place a document that is in wide use, which is a personal guarantee from the seller's beneficial owner, which covers those two warranties of title and lien. So in other words, that if something does occur later on, the buyer, at least in theory, can go against a physical person being the individual who's behind the seller company. So it's an additional protection to the buyer. It's important in terms of making sure that the purchase is legally secure.
Brilliant. Lots of moving parts.
Yeah, highly complex arrangements. We're talking about yachts which can be flagged anywhere in the world, owning companies anywhere in the world as well. Generally, we're dealing with predominantly, I would say, English law transactions. English law and having an English qualified yacht lawyer is therefore very important. But extremely fascinating stuff, but complex. And so we always suggest to people that they make sure that they have taken proper advice.
Thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
Thank you.
Now, if you're not interested in buying a second-hand yacht, chances are that's because you're building one. So now let's turn our attention to the complex world of new build contracts. Fortunately, we have HFW partner Alex Sayer here to answer the key questions owners may have when embarking on a build. From drafting watertight contracts and managing subcontractors to navigating payment structures, milestone inspections, liquidated damages and dispute resolution, Alex will help us through the essential legal and practical considerations that keep complex yacht projects on track. So Alex, tell me, refund guarantees, are they still an effective insurance for a buyer, and what would you advise?
Yes, refund guarantees are still almost always the preferred form of security for a buyer entering into a construction contract. And the reason for that is that they, if a worst case scenario should fall apart, project and the buyer is forced to terminate it, they really offer a neat and straightforward get out, or at least as neat and as straightforward as you can get in those circumstances. How it would work is that if you had terminated the contract, you would go to the builder. You would ask them to make the refund of your pre-delivery installments as required by the contract. If they failed to do so, you would then be in a position to go to the guarantor, bank or insurance company and ask them to make the refund. Typically speaking, it will be the case that the shipyard have the ability then to dispute the buyer's entitlement to a refund and to refer the matter to arbitration in such a way that then the guarantor will only have to make a payment if and when a favourable arbitration award is obtained. But you know, subject to that, you have full security for the pre-delivery instalments that that you've made. And really, the only sort of disadvantages there are to refund guarantees are, first, you may find that in a rising market like the one we've seen over the last 3 or 4 years, if all you get back is a refund with a bit of interest and you have to go back into the market, that refund won't go as far as it would have done when you originally entered into the contract. So your purchase power may be eroded by dint of inflation. The other thing is, obviously, you know, a buyer doesn't enter into a construction contract in the hope that it's going to get a refund. It enters into a construction contract in the expectation that it's going to get a completed yacht at the end of it. Well, a refund is not that. But, you know, subject to those things, then yeah, refund guarantees are really the best form of security that that a buyer can hope for. The alternative is to take title during construction, but you know, there are many more challenges associated with that, so it just doesn't result in the same sort of neat exit.
Great. Okay, so tell me about how can a buyer limit a yard's ability to inflate costs or delay delivery when handling change orders?
Well, wanting to sound flippant, the best thing you can do as a buyer is to not have change orders in the first instance. So that means that you want to have the design fully scoped out. You want to have a very clear, comprehensive and detailed specification. So as really to limit the possibility of a change order being required. Because as soon as you have a modification negotiation in play, there is inevitably the risk that the consequential effects will go beyond what is strictly required for the performance of that modification. What we would like to see when acting for a buyer in those circumstances is for any of the consequential effects following from a modification to be properly reasoned and evidenced. So, you know, you would want to see, you know, if it's suppliers and subcontractors that are going to be providing the work, you'd want to see those quotes and estimates. You'd want to see that the builder has made a proper estimate of the number of man hours that are going to be involved in performing the modification. And following from that, there are things you can do when negotiating the construction contract to manage the consequences. So you might, for instance, see labour rates for production staff and for design engineering staff, so that at the beginning of the project you've locked in those labour rates, and you know they may be subject to adjustment for inflation as the year's gone by, but fundamentally you know what you can expect to pay. Similarly, you might agree the margin on subcontracted work so that you know exactly what you're going to be paying to the shipyard on top of what's actually going to the supplier and subcontractor. So you really need to limit the number of variables involved to get as much detail as you can regarding how the modification is going to be implemented. And ideally there you've got the fundamental principles of the contract, which tell you how that's all going to be costed.
Okay, great. And obviously refits, you handle refits as well?
Yes, we do. And the same principles apply, but obviously with refit work, there is a much greater probability of something unforeseen arising during the course of the project because of the much increased possibility of emergent work arising, at least when you're dealing with a new build. If some work has to be dismantled, reversed, you know, what's behind the panel in question, you know, what condition it's in, or at least what condition it ought to be in. Whereas in the case of a refit contract, you know, until you get under the bonnet, no one really knows what you're dealing with, and you may find that parts of the equipment and machinery and actually they're actually in much poorer condition than you anticipated when you entered into the contract. So, I mean, with refit contracts, again, vitally important to make sure that you've got a clear understanding of how emergent work will be treated and costed.
Okay, great. Well, sometimes things go wrong, so and there's dispute, unforeseen circumstances, dispute. What would you recommend?
The first thing I would recommend is before you even sign a contract, you know, make sure you've chosen the right counterparty, because that will be vitally important as regards how things are dealt with if a problem arises during a project. What we ideally like to see is these things resolved through dialogue and compromise between the parties, rather than references to the contract and enforcement of strict legal rights. If you do end up in a dispute scenario with a shipyard, I mean, again, this goes back to the construction contract, but it must be said the overwhelming majority of disputes we see in relation to your construction contracts are technical rather than legal in nature. So what we always like to see is provision for purely technical disputes to be resolved by an independent technical expert rather than through legal proceedings. And that's really is to both parties' advantage to have a mechanism whereby purely technical disputes can be resolved quickly, cost effectively, by reference to a technical expert rather than legal proceedings. And what we see often with legal proceedings is that there's often a party in whose interest it is to delay matters. There's one side who doesn't mind if it takes several weeks or months to arrive at resolution. And what we see is that legal proceedings suit that party more than the other, with the result that if we have simple technical disputes that can only be resolved by way of arbitration or court proceedings, what you're left with is a significant practical impediment to enforcing your rights.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Alex.
And finally, we have HFW Legal Director Jessica Taylor and Senior Associate George Kay, who are going to answer the key questions your owners often have when chartering their vessel for the first time. From understanding the main provisions of an amoeba contract to security deposits, guest misconduct, and insurance, they will guide us through the essential legal and practical considerations of welcoming guests on board.
Okay, George, we're going to start with you. So, George, how common are cases where guest misconduct is a problem?
Sure. So as a lawyer, it's pretty difficult to give a figure. I mean, generally, when we're getting involved in these sorts of issues, they're on the more serious end. So we, as lawyers who look at the charter agreement, see issues ranging from, you know, charterers that don't like the quality of the yacht, they're not happy with the yacht, to damage being done on board, all the way through to charterer misconduct and things going wrong. But as I say, it's quite difficult to put a figure on it because the worst sorts of misconduct are generally dealt with quite quickly. So the charter agreement sets out a list of circumstances that would set out how an owner or a captain should deal with those circumstances. The most serious ones simply allowing for an immediate termination. So we would often not even see those issues as lawyers. The ones that we would see are probably the more arguable ones to do with behaviour. But I would say that we don't see it that often because at the end of the day, you know, these are people paying a lot of money for big boats and these sorts of issues get sorted out quite easily.
Okay, great. Jess or George, you might want to do this both together. If a charter guest causes damage to the yacht, what are the owner's legal options for recovery? And how is liability usually proven or contested?
Well, the charter agreement provides that the yacht must be redelivered in the same condition as it was delivered to the charterer, fair wear and tear accepted. So the charterer has an obligation to redeliver the yacht in the same condition. And if damage has been caused by the charterer due to its negligence, then the owner can look to the charterer to rectify that damage by way of financial damages to the owner, essentially. Very often there is a security deposit held in escrow for the duration of the charter, which would be released at the end of the charter if there weren't any problems, but if there have been problems, it will be held for such period as is needed for the parties to try and come to an agreement on any damage caused and make a deduction from the security deposit, or potentially they, in the most serious of circumstances, they may need to arbitrate in respect of any damage caused, and that's where George's expertise would come in.
Thanks, Jess.
Yes, tell us what happens when things get nasty.
Yeah, I mean, sure. So I would generally say that a lot of these issues get sorted out, right? So as Jess says, we're talking about when issues are not fair wear and tear. When they're not fair wear and tear, it's the charterer's responsibility. Disputes arise when there is a disagreement between a charterer and an owner as to whether something is fair wear and tear or not. Now, when that disagreement takes place, the right of recourse under the MEBA charter agreement would be arbitration. What arbitration is, it's a consensual process between the owners and the charterers. So what happens is that the owner would appoint their arbitrator, the charterer would appoint their arbitrator, and then if those two arbitrators can't agree on something, they would appoint a third. That arbitration tribunal would then, it would be up to them to determine, you know, on the balance of probabilities and, you know, adopting a reasonable assessment of the facts, who is liable for the particular issue. Personally, that's 9 times out of 10 of the issues I deal with when it comes to yacht charters. It's arbitrations arising out of charter contracts.
Great. And what kinds of misconduct can justify an immediate termination of a charter? And how is it enforceable?
So there is a list of offences which a charterer can commit. Some of them are the most serious that would potentially result in a member of the crew or the vessel being detained, fined or imprisoned, or the vessel being detained, arrested or fined. And in that regard, the charterer has to indemnify the owner against any losses or damages that may arise from, for example, a detention. There is also in the charter agreement a zero tolerance policy which is expressed for physical or sexual assault or the possession or use of any illegal drugs or any weapons. And for all of those types of offence which I've just mentioned, an owner can immediately terminate the charter. So the captain can give notice to the charterer that the charter is terminated and would take them to the nearest convenient port for them to disembark. There are other types of offence, infringements, which the charterer should not breach under the charter agreement. And they are, you know, ranging from, I suppose, smoking in areas where you shouldn't smoke, general misconduct on board. There's a list, but they're not as serious. And for those, the captain can give the, you know, typically the captain would give a charterer notice, you know, don't do it again, and talk to the charterer about it and try and prevent that happening again on board.
Okay, great. You've talked a lot about charter agreements, but let's just crunch that down and look at that at a deeper level. For there is two main types of charter agreements, I believe. Is that right, George?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I'll do the intro and then Jess can talk about the work that she's been doing. So we generally see two sorts of charter agreements. There is the MEBA charter agreement, the Mediterranean Yacht Brokers Association charter agreement, which is generally the charter agreement that you see for charters in the Med. It's an English law contract and has been around with various revisions for quite some time. In the Caribbean, you are more likely to see a charter agreement called the EBA or IYBA charter agreement, which is subject to US law. And yeah, you generally see that in the Caribbean. Those are the two main ones that are around. There are a few other sorts that are a little bit more niche and a little bit more bespoke. As an English lawyer sitting in Monaco, I only ever really look at the MEBA form because obviously I can't not qualify to advise on US legal positions. But it's been around a long time. It sets out a pretty clear apportionment of liability between an owner and a charterer. And it's generally, we would say, slightly more of an owner-friendly document in that it probably gives a few more rights to an owner than it does to a charterer. But it's easily amended and the terms are pretty clear. And Jess, maybe you want to say what you've been doing recently.
Yes, to add on to what George said there, the agreement is designed, really, it's an industry standard contract that's designed for parties to be able to enter it without the involvement of lawyers, usually at the contract stage. And we would only normally get involved, or personally as a transactional lawyer, I would normally only get involved if there was some special nature to the charter, something particular that somebody wanted to do, a special location, or maybe a film is going to be recorded on board, they're using the yacht as a filming location, that type of thing. So George sees them when they go wrong, and I see them at the beginning stage. But in the ordinary course, they get signed up without really any trouble. And what we have been lucky enough to be involved in recently was helping the MEBA Charter Committee in refreshing the charter agreement. It hadn't been revised for several years. I think the last version was 2017. So it was 8 years since it was last refreshed. And in the spring of this year, the new version was launched. It had several additional new clauses to really modernize it. A KYC clause giving the parties involved the ability to ask for KYC on the other parties to the extent that they need it for anti-money laundering or compliance in the jurisdiction where they are based. Data protection and privacy, as we typically see in most contracts these days where there is personal data that's gathered, setting out how that will be held in accordance with local law. Quite a detailed confidentiality clause. Of course, a lot of the information that's held on charterers can be very sensitive in terms of particular health issues, passports, dietary requirements, also what happens on board during someone's private holiday. So it was felt that a stronger confidentiality clause was necessary. Obviously, owners were always concerned about social media and keeping charter guests' information totally private, and equally concerned that a charterer could go on social media and put out information about the potential beneficial owner of the yacht itself. So it's a mutual clause providing for confidentiality for both parties. A sanctions clause reflecting the nature of the world in which we live today, and a liability clause in relation to liability for delays in being able to transfer funds and to allow the brokers some leeway when sometimes transfers can get held up, particularly when everyone is facing additional scrutiny on financial transfers. So other than that, several of the existing clauses were expanded upon, tightened up, generally just trying to modernise and refresh the wording so it's easier to understand and clearer in its language.
Great, thank you. Okay, so and finally, George, can you legally screen charter clients for red flags such as prior insurance claims, misconduct reports or criminal history?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I would certainly say that any prudent owner would be doing their own due diligence on any charterer that they're looking to charter their boat to. Obviously, you're talking about a lot of money in exchange for a very high value asset. And so it would be prudent for any owner to do due diligence in those circumstances. I can't comment on it directly, but I'm sure that brokers will also undertake publicly available checks on charterers, criminal records, background checks, that sort of thing, for any new charterer that they're working with. And it's a pretty small industry, so I think if charterers have bad reputations, I wouldn't be surprised if that would quickly go around the industry. Obviously, we can't comment on whether the big broking houses have a list. You know, that's a central database of individual charterers, but I wouldn't necessarily be surprised if there was one. That said, I think it's probably important to acknowledge that this is a private and confidential document. And so, and it also incorporates, as I previously discussed, an arbitration provision in it, which is a private and confidential dispute resolution process. So to the extent that an owner has had or a charterer has had disputes in the past, those disputes would be private and confidential and wouldn't necessarily be known outside in the market. So I think the short answer in answer to your question is I wouldn't be surprised if owners did do background checks, but there's nothing in the charter agreement that says that they have to.
Jess, anything to add?
No, I think that covers it.
Brilliant. Thanks, guys. Thanks very much.
Very welcome. Good fun.
Thanks. So that's all we have time for this week. I hope you've enjoyed our special boat briefing podcast. We'd like to extend our thanks to Andrew, Jess, George and Alex for giving up time out of their busy schedules to record this. Look out for their articles in the yacht advice section of boatinternational.com, which delve into each subject in a lot more detail. As always, don't forget to subscribe, leave us a review, and follow us at Boat International for more stories across the world of yachting. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.